through the Alaska Airlines studios.
This is Tom, Jake, and Stacy on 710 ESPN Seattle. Streaming live on the 710 Sports app and at 710sports.com.
Now, here are your hosts, Tom Wassel, Jake Heaps, and Stacy Ross.
Welcome into Tom, Jake, and Stacy. Terrific show for you today. We only had about, what, half an hour to react to the Greg Olsen stuff yesterday.
Just about.
So we're going to do a lot more on that, of course. Hey, Jake, how come you don't, like, clap or yell before we start the show anymore?
Yeah, you used to.
Because it, you guys didn't seem to love it.
No, we did love it.
I do it internally.
Oh, you do?
Yeah, I do it internally. In my mind, I visualize and I get myself hyped up.
I've been doing it internally, too.
You have.
But it's Jake. In your brain, exactly. It's still Jake doing it.
I'm imagining Jake. Well, maybe we should bring that back. You know, one of the tricky things about being on the air when breaking news comes down is that you don't always get to say the exact thing that you want to say because you don't think of it at the time. Maybe you think about it later and you think, all right, well, what did I say that wrong or did I leave something out or whatever? You know, I think we had a pretty good discussion about, pretty thorough discussion about Greg Olsen yesterday. I think that at the end of the day, one thing that I'm just flat happy about with the Seahawks, they won a battle with two other teams for a guy that was, I won't say coveted, but there were three teams that were in on this guy, in on Greg Olsen. They all clearly wanted him.
Mm-hmm.
So the Seahawks were the ones that convinced him to come all the way up here, a place he hasn't been before, right? A place he had essentially no relationship with, maybe with the exception of Russell Wilson in that little picture we saw yesterday.
Right. That's about it. And you say those three teams, and really, Greg Olsen, people have to remember, Greg Olsen determined who those three teams were going to be. So he determined that it was the right time for him to walk away from the Carolina Panthers. He also determined who the three teams he thought would potentially be the best fits for him. And Washington Redskins, you know, people would maybe raise their eyebrow at that, but it's because of Ron Rivera, his head coach that he loves so much and pretty played the majority of his career for. And then you look at the Buffalo Bills, he had familiarity with the offensive coordinator there, and then the Seahawks. So I think that this was a awesome get for them, like I said yesterday. And I just want to reiterate some points here with Greg Olsen. Is that although Greg Olsen is 35 years old, and although people, you know, kind of put together 3 years together and it combines to a bigger number, you know, 2 years prior, he had some serious injury history. Last year, he played in 14 games. They didn't make the playoffs. He played in 14 games and really had minor injury, you know, sat out two games for minor injury purposes, but was majority of the year healthy. And with a team that was dysfunctional, an organization that was dysfunctional, a quarterback in Kyle Allen that ended up playing because Cam Newton got hurt, he produced over 50 catches, over 500 yards. His touchdown numbers were limited, but that's also, I would put that more on quarterback play than anything else. And when you watch the tape of Greg Olsen last year, he still has juice. Like, he still has the ability to play. This is not them signing Jason Witten. This is not them signing Mike Iupati, or for that matter, Ziggy Ansah, guys who are coming off of legit injury problems the year prior, and they are serious question marks. Greg Olsen, to me, isn't a major question mark at this point in time. Am I going to guarantee that he's healthy for the entire season? No, that's not what I'm doing. But I do think that this is a pretty dang good move on their end. And if Greg Olsen is what you saw from him last year in 2019 and over the majority of his career, you're going to get a pretty dang good player. And I think Seahawks fans should be more excited about it than be pessimistic about it.
I'm wondering if you guys feel the same way I do about this now that I've had time to kind of sit on the idea and marinate on it, because I think the number one critique, and I'm sure you guys saw it tweeting about it too and the responses that you were getting, but the number one critique was his age, that he's an older player. He's going to be one of the older players in your locker room, much less just one of the older players you're going to sign in free agency. And I kept thinking to myself, The Seahawks are a team that still very much has a postseason and Super Bowl window. You have that as long as you have a quarterback in his prime and as long as you have stability in your front office and with your coaching staff. I think that they're one of the teams who every year is expected to at least get to the playoffs. And to be honest, they've done it every year with the exception of one of Russell Wilson's seasons. That said, they have some holes, and you're not always going to be able to find the youngest, the cheapest, and the best talent to fill those needs. And you need to sometimes prioritize where you want to spend your money. We've been talking about the Seahawks having $60 million to spend in free agency and in their draft. But you still have to be cognizant of where you're spending that money. If you're spending a lot of it on defense, you're not going to be able to go out and get a really expensive frontline tight end. That being said, I think that Greg Olsen in this system brings a veteran savvy, a veteran presence. He's not coming off this big, serious injury. You have depth concerns at tight end. It's at least someone else that you're bringing in. And trying to bring him over from Carolina's offense is drastically different than when you tried to bring Jimmy Graham in over from New Orleans. You're bringing in someone to essentially do exactly what you would coach up a kind of tight end to do in your own system. So, I mean, again,
yeah, great scheme
you're not,
fit.
I'm not, it's a great scheme fit, and I have a hard time knocking a team, and I understand the critique of not getting a young player or a long-term solution, but I have a hard time doing that when the expectation is that they're going to be trying to do that at more expensive positions.
Right, and that makes total sense to me from that standpoint. And the other thing that I want people to understand is this is really a trade-in, trade-out situation. When you look at it from a cap number standpoint, Greg Olsen, 5.5 guaranteed, as you rattled off yesterday as the breaking news came in, Tom, and $7 million that he can earn total. But who are they going to most likely cut? That is going to be Ed Dixon. When they cut Ed Dixon, that saves you $3 million on the salary cap. So essentially your deal that you're getting for, you know, Greg Olsen in its totality would be $4 million. If you're looking at it from the standpoint of
one tight end to another tight end.
Exactly. One tight end to another tight end. We subtract Ed Dixon's cap hit. We add Greg Olsen. You are only adding $4 million more that were on your original cap. So when you look at it from that standpoint, I think this is a fantastic move that they are ultimately going to make for the Seahawks. It makes a ton of sense for all the reasons that, Stacey, that you just mentioned. A great scheme fit, a guy that's going to fit in. They're not going to have to worry or figure out how to make it work here in Seattle. He'll just be able to plug and play from that standpoint. And you mentioned earlier, Tom, really bringing him over here for the Seahawks. He had no prior relationship, really any connection to the West Coast. The only connection that he had was Russell Wilson. And the fact that he wanted to play for a playoff contender and wanted to play for one of the best quarterbacks in the NFL, I think it speaks volumes.
I was just going to say, there's also a very real possibility, as Tom Pelissero points out in cut number three right here, that you could have two very good tight ends on the field if both remain healthy.
Russell Wilson really wanted to bring in Greg Olsen. Also, Will Dissly, who we saw flash in a really big way last season, is going to be coming off of a torn Achilles. Now, my understanding is they fully expect in Seattle for Will Dissly to be healthy and ready to go by week one next season. But the reality is, for all the talent that he has shown on the field, Dissly's only played 10 NFL games at this point. He's had a couple of big-time injuries. So the downside here in terms of the baseline for Greg Olsen is you bring in another guy, you're able to patch it together, two guys who maybe are going to get nicked up through the course of the season. The upside is you potentially have Dissly and Olsen on the field together. That is a tough 1-2 punch that can create some mismatches for opposing defense.
Yeah, whether you have both guys on the field at the same time or you don't have to worry about either guy getting hurt, right? Because you have both guys you can go to. Now, if you just run into bad luck and one guy is old and he gets hurt and Will Dissly just continues to be what Will Dissly's been so far.
A possibility.
Yeah, which is a guy who just gets hurt. That's just bad luck. But what they're doing by bringing Olsen in is they're insuring against a Will Dissly injury and they're adding to the potential that Will Dissly might be able to give them at that position.
And they're upgrading. Like, I would say that they are upgrading. If you had asked me if you'd asked me just point blank, if you could have a healthy Will Dissly and a healthy Greg Olsen, I'd take that all day, every day. If you ask me a healthy Jacob Hollister to a healthy Greg Olsen, I'm going to take Greg Olsen every single day, and I probably pick him over Will Dissly from the standpoint he is more a dynamic pass catcher than Dissly is. So when you talk about that and you talk about the situation that they fell in last year, they didn't have a tight end on their roster that could do all the things that Will Dissly brought to them in terms of run blocking and being able to catch the football. And now they do with Greg Olsen. And now hopefully you can have both of those guys. And yesterday I talked about 12 personnel, that they can be in 12 personnel. It makes their play action game that much stronger. It makes their run game that much stronger and more effective. And so I really like this move overall, and think this can be a really good situation for the Seahawks and for them to continue to keep improving. And we'll get into this discussion more and more as we get on, but this patchwork situation, if for 1 year in 2020, I'm okay with Greg Olsen just being a patchwork guy here in Seattle for 1 year.
This hour of Tom, Jake, and Stacey is brought to you by Car Toys. Right now, I got three questions.
It's time for three questions.
Can't wait for it.
Every day at 12 after 12, Tom Wassel's burning questions for Jake Heaps and Stacey Rost.
Enough with the "we got to protect the kids" nonsense.
Is it a problem that the most interesting storyline in baseball right now is a negative one?
I don't know about that. I think scandal dominates headlines, and that's always how it's been. I just started listening to this podcast called American Scandal, and season one is about Balco, and the entire thing, just it's just how it works. Like, people love a good story. You want to see good news and positive news, but a scandal and something that makes people angry will always dominate the news over anything else. And we may not like it, and we may talk about how we wish it was good and positive news, but sometimes it's because there's an important conversation to come from that anger.
I would counter that by saying, in the NFL, when you have a scandal, you have a scandal, but usually that's offset by a Lamar Jackson, a Patrick Mahomes, mm-hmm. like all the greatness that we see. In baseball, they don't have anything offsetting
the scandal. You're saying nothing's balancing it.
Right.
What would be the closest thing?
Them getting to the season as soon as possible and then playing the playoffs again. Like, to Tom's point, there really isn't anything. I mean, the NFL, I mean, it is a machine in terms of, you know, look, we're talking about free agency. We're talking, you know, pretty soon we're going to be talking about the combine. We're going to be talking about the draft. There are benchmarks all along the way for us to stay intrigued and stay attached to, where baseball really doesn't have that same thing. They're going into spring training, and it's really not that exciting.
Yeah, in the NFL, think about it. The NFL, the season, the games, help to wash away the scandal to the point where we forget about it.
Correct.
In baseball, you think we're not going to be thinking about the Astros
but part of that,
the entirety of the season?
I agree. I think it'll lessen, but it will continue to be a story point. And part of that is that everyone is watching a lot of those games. I mean, you, me, the three of us are tuning in for a Monday night, a Thursday night, a Sunday night game, no matter who's playing. It's like Salk said, with baseball, it's a lot more of a regional fan base, that you might not be watching any Twins games all year. I know you won't, Tom. You definitely will, because your grandparents, huge Twins fans?
No, but you're on the right track.
I'm getting there with it.
Yeah.
Point being that unless you have family ties, you're probably watching whatever games are maybe in the division or just regionally. But I mean, so maybe that's part of it, is there's just less of a national headline with baseball. And this is a national headline because cheating is a national headline. Maybe baseball needs a Cinderella story.
The other part that I think is a major factor in this, in terms of this continuing to fester, is because I think Major League Baseball and Rob Manfred have not handled this well whatsoever.
Yeah.
I don't think that they have gone about this the right way. I don't think that there's really been a punishment that people can attach to and move on from. And so because there is a quote-unquote injustice that people feel from players, not just fans, but players and other people around, other teams around the league, that this isn't going away. And that's a shame of it in this situation, where you can't just look at it and say, okay, they're stripped of their title, or they're getting a postseason ban, or X players are getting suspended. There's really nothing for you to look at and say, okay, I feel like I can really move on from this.
Question two.
Number two.
I'm changing the question on you, by the way.
Oh,
here.
Dang it.
What would you guys be more concerned about with Greg Olsen? His ability to block or catch passes?
Block.
What are you more concerned about?
Just given his age and all that.
Yeah. Honestly, is it weird that I say neither? Like, I'm not concerned about it at all.
You have to pick one, so I'm not the bad guy.
I am more, if I'm going to say what my concern is in the running game. But as I watch Greg Olsen, he is a complete tight end. He is. He's been his entire career. He's been a willing and very effective run blocker. He's been one of the best, you know, receiving tight ends in the NFL. So I'm not saying that he's going to come out and be this Pro Bowl guy. He's going to have 1,000 yards. He's going to, you know, do all these amazing things statistically. But I do think that he can be a awesome third option for Russell Wilson in critical situations that he can rely on and lean on at different times. That's kind of who he's been at, who he's been throughout his career.
Where do you guys think he ranked on his own team in terms of receptions last year?
Third. Second.
Yeah,
third.
I would say second.
No, Thor behind guessing. DJ Moore.
Oh, no. Third. Because Christian McCaffrey Moore. And Moore and then Olsen.
I thought it would be second because I forgot about DJ Moore, but
yeah.
He was actually fourth.
Behind Humphrey, D, there's who's a D the, name.
Who's the other guy?
D.
It's McCaffrey at 116.
DJ I know this. Moore it was part of Panthers.
Curtis Samuel at 54 catches, Olsen 52.
Yeah. That's, that's pretty good in terms of the, I mean, did they throw the ball that much?
Kyle Allen threw.
I guess because
489 times.
I guess they got into a lot of situations, just like when they played Seattle, that they were down and behind a lot of times and having to throw the ball quite a bit.
Yeah, 633 total attempts between Cam, Will Greer, and Kyle Allen. Next,
number three,
Will Greer.
That guy's not good.
Can a commissioner ever satisfy everyone?
No. The job of the commissioner, almost, it's part of the job description, is you're going to make people upset. Like, you're never going to satisfy everybody. I think that there's commissioners that people have respected over the years, that widely they've respected, but there's always going to be people that are upset for one thing or another. I mean, I look at David Stern, right? Like, David Stern was a guy that across the NBA widely was pretty respected. Like, he wasn't hated by the NBA. But to Seattle fans, to Sonics fans, to, you know, certain markets, yeah, I mean, David Stern was not a very popular guy. So you're never going to please anybody. But I do think that in confrontations like this, that won a league just by the nature of it, like we talked about the NFL, can help a commissioner out, alleviate the pressure because, you know, something's always happening in the NFL for Roger Goodell. But also, I just think that Rob Manfred, and when you compare to Major League Baseball, just has not handled this particular issue very well and has done little to satisfy people or not put his foot in his mouth.
It's funny. I wrote almost exactly what Jake said. I wrote, no, period. That's the job, period. You are catering food. By that, you can't be too salty, you can't be too spicy. You exist to serve a purpose, but don't really leave anyone feeling satisfied.
That's great. That's
the
a
job
great
of
analogy.
The commissioner.
I don't think that Rob Manfred thought that this was going to be that big of a deal. I think he thought people would look at sign stealing as, oh, well, that's something that we've always done in the past. And so once this comes to light, people won't care as much as they did. Problem is, the team that did it won the World Series.
Right.
And has been winning 100 games a year for the last couple of years. That's a big problem.
And knocked some powerful franchises out of the way to get there.
Right.
So the Yankees are not pleased. It's not just the Dodgers that are upset about this.
Right. And now you got everybody joining in. I mean, we saw LeBron. He's been tweeting out here and there about it. I'm going to tell you guys right up front, though. If this thing goes on and on and on, there will come a point where I start defending Manfred.
No.
Yeah, there will.
No, Tom.
There's a point at which the criticism will feel like it's forced and overdone. Like, where we've said all that needs to be said, and if we keep on keeping on with the grandstanding and the finger-pointing, it's going to seem really fake.
I will say I'm much less disappointed in the way that Manfred has handled it, because you're essentially like, it's a bureaucratic kind of job. Like, your job is to try to have as much PR and have the least amount of a ripple effect that could damage the league as possible. And that sometimes means making really conservative decisions that don't push any kind of status quo too much. because your job is to just maintain and protect the integrity of the game, not necessarily to levy punishment all the time. So I think the way he's handled it, it was no matter what, he would have had to be absolutely perfect for people not to be disappointed with the atmosphere surrounding this scandal right now. Everyone is on edge and defensive and angry. And the minute he said just a piece of metal, it's like, oh, that's gonna really get people going. But I'm much more disappointed in the way that the Astros have handled it versus what Manfred has done. Manfred, I think that there are many other people in that same role as commissioner, they would have a very similar approach, especially if they needed to levy or use like a blanket immunity to get a kind of cooperation.
Mm-hmm. Because as we said,
it limits what you can do.
Yeah, I'm frustrated by it all. Like, I'm frustrated by the Astros players. I'm frustrated with Manfred. But I do get to the point of what you're saying, Tom. If we come out, like, for example, Manfred in his press conference, you know, called the trophy a piece of metal, right? Like, you can poke fun at him and you can say that that's ridiculous and how angry can you really be at that? I mean, to me, it just is another drop in the bucket. But ultimately, if he continues to make little comments like that, that's not going to bother me. It's my initial thought and feeling of how this is should be handled, how it's been handled. I've said my piece about it, and I feel like I can move on. I think people know very clearly as to where I stand on it, and nothing's really going to change at this point in time.
I think we'd feel a heck of a lot worse if Jerry DePoto had finally put together a really competitive team in 2017, and we got to the brink of the playoffs and were edged out by the Astros, right? Think about that, how we'd feel then.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we're Mariner fans. We're used to watching them clock in with 70 wins, so it doesn't feel like
it feels
we
like
really
you don't have a horse
hit
in this race.
Right. But
other than
the Dodger fans do, and Yankee fans do, and I guess you could say Red Sox fans, but they may have been cheating too.
Right.
So we'll see what ends up happening with them.
It's a good point, and the fallout from this is going to be fascinating to watch. And I hope at some point, and it will happen at some point, but that we can move on and that we can, you know, really start focusing on baseball and trying to make sure that it's staying at its best in terms of progressing with the game. But it's going to be really hard for people to get over this when there's really no punishment that's being levied.
We're going to get Sox thoughts on Greg Olson and a couple other things next. Tom, Jake, and Stacy, 710 ESPN Seattle.
You're listening to Tom, Jake, and Stacy.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios.
Streaming live on the 710 Sports app and at 710sports.com.
Now, here are your hosts, Tom Wassel, Jake Heaps, and Stacy Rost.
And it's a pleasure to have Mike Salk in here, as we do every single day. Mike, we tend to get breaking news on our show late in the day, so you haven't had a chance to really respond to this yet. Do you consider Greg Olson a straight-up weapon for Russell Wilson?
I think so. I don't know if he's a prime weapon, but I think he should add to their passing game and not hurt their running game. I don't know whether he's necessarily here to block, but this isn't a Jimmy Graham situation where he's incapable of doing that. I mean, look, this is a nice thing to add. You didn't have to give much up to get him. He's not hugely expensive. It's a position that seems to matter in the NFL. And you go look at the two teams that were in the Super Bowl. If you were looking for one thing that they had in common other than wearing red, it's that they had arguably the two best tight ends in the game were on those two teams. So, you know, pass receiving multiple types of tight ends seems to be really helpful, and some of the better offenses have utilized those tight ends and a couple of tight ends at once in different ways. You know, if you go into this season with him, and if Disley can get healthy with his ability to be a blocker and also catch the ball, and then you add in Hollister, who really is sort of a third tight end who's more of a pass receiver, I like that group. It also means that this gives you a whole lot more freedom now, because you didn't have to give up any of your comp picks in signing him to go get some guys defensively that you really want and need. You know, I was talking to Howdy this morning. He was telling me, asking me if I would trade a second round pick and spend $17 million for Von Miller. And I said, yeah, where do I sign up? If that deal is on the table, I couldn't make that deal fast enough. Let's go. Bring in Von Miller, put him on one side, sign Jadeveon Clowney, put him on the other, and then go draft somebody who can really help you in your secondary. And you've made your team significantly better overnight. Yeah, I'm all in on that. Where do I sign up?
Yeah, I would agree with you on that. I do think that this is a nice move for them overall for offensive purposes, but also in terms of that, I think it signifies the opportunity where they signed Greg Olsen. Now they can really focus on the defensive side of the ball, and they can put more of their free agent money into the defensive side. And, you know, maybe you still acquire an offensive lineman. That is still a possibility, but I do see more of that going to the defensive side of the ball. And so when this initial move was made with Greg Olsen, what was your reaction? Indifference? Was it?
No, I'm happy. Anytime you get a name player, you can't help but be happy. Whether you know it's a good idea or not, you can't help. Yeah, I know who that guy is, and I've seen him play, and he's always been pretty good. And yeah, of course you're happy. Just sort of the instant you realize there's a good player coming to your team. I think that the importance and use of tight ends has changed over time. Or maybe it's just the perception. You know, I remember being younger, and the idea of a tight end was like, oh, he's a security blanket for the quarterback, right? Third down, he's got a long wingspan, and that's just your security blanket for the quarterback, and especially a young quarterback. You wanted to get a tight end, you know, growing up where I did, you know, the Ben Coates for Drew Bledsoe was a big thing. Like, well, he's got Coates, so he can just always throw it up to him on third down and everything will be fine. I think the way tight ends have been used has changed over the last couple of years, and now it's really the value in the tight end is more about that play action. Is it a running play, RPO, play action? And the fact that when you send out a couple of tight ends, maybe two at once, you're not telling the defense whether you're running or passing. Mm-hmm. You're really leaving it open to a lot of possibilities. And, you know, Brock was the first one to explain this to me. I don't know, must have been 2010 or so, 2012, when the Patriots started the Aaron Hernandez, Rob Gronkowski offense. Obviously, Hernandez had some of his own problems off the field, but
right,
a lot of the effectiveness of that offense coming off what they had done earlier with Randy Moss and Wes Welker was, no, you don't know whether they're running or passing, and those guys are both legitimate run blockers. When they get out there, you can really stack them over, you know, a tackle and have a really powerful side of the line of scrimmage, or maybe you're splitting one or both of them out because they're that good in the receiving game. You're really forcing the defense to make a lot of choices without knowing any information. So, you know, in Pete Carroll's system where play action is such a huge part along with the running game, I think having a solid tight end or a pair of them could be incredibly important. And I don't mean Jimmy Graham, who's incapable of blocking. A couple of guys who want to block are willing blockers, but also can get off the ball and receive. That seems incredibly important.
We've been debating whether or not the Seahawks have, I'm just going to say, like a patchwork problem. The idea of rather than signing young guys to long-term contracts or just drafting successfully, and obviously you don't always know whether you're going to hit in the draft. Sometimes you do and sometimes you don't. You look at some of the big headlines and signings that they've made, the splash signings, and a lot of them have been short-term ones. Do you think that's just the byproduct of a successful team, or do you think that that's the approach that they've decided to take with the window they have?
First of all, I think it's a great question.
Thanks. It's not mine.
I don't entirely know the answer to it. Take the credit for it, whether it's yours or not.
It's just mine and not at all a conversation we were having.
But it's a good conversation. I think they need to draft better. The number one thing that the Seahawks could do to improve where they're at is draft better than they have for the last 4 or 5 years. They just haven't hit on enough big-time talented guys in the draft. That's not to say there have been none. Frank Clark and Tyler Lockett, and there have been a few others in there, and you know, it looks like DK may be one as well. But they need to hit more often in the draft, similarly to how they did at the beginning of the John Schneider era. The second thing is, yeah, it would be nice if some of these signings were of the on-the-way-up variety, the way Cliff Averill and Michael Bennett were. Those weren't guys at the end of their career into their 30s. So, yeah, I mean, I guess that's why you are well within your rights to call this sort of patchwork, just you know, patch up this, patch up that, hole in the dike. But I think you got to do some of those things. Like, I think a good team is going to be a mixture of, you know, really good draft picks, some young free agents, and some patchwork guys to fill the holes. I'm okay with the patchwork guys as long as you're not overcommitting to them or counting on them. I don't think they're counting on Greg Olsen being a star. They have Will Dissly. They have got other guys who can catch the ball. They don't need him to catch 100 balls and do something he's never done before. But they are going to need that from someone. They're going to need that on the defensive line, especially at defensive end. And I don't know whether Von Miller's that guy or whether it's somebody else who's a free agent or a trade candidate that I don't know enough about right now. But that has to be their focal point. And in that spot, I don't think patchwork's going to cut it.
I want to go back over to baseball for a second here. Do you think that Rob Manfred is in any trouble whatsoever?
I think, I mean, if he is, and Roger Goodell has kept his job for the last 15 years, then I give up. Like, I give up.
Well, maybe a good start is not calling the trophy
a piece of metal.
The commissioner's trophy.
That might be a good start.
I don't know. I think those things get blown out of proportion, too. Like, it is a piece of metal. It means a lot more than that. But I think his point, if you listen to him, was, you know, taking back this piece of metal does not change what really happened. And I agree with him. Should he have said it that way? No, especially in, you know, this day and age where everything you say gets judged and twisted and turned around and people are looking to hate on commissioners. That's part of the gig. No, I don't think he should be in trouble.
Can anything outside of scandal that he's involved in really get him fired?
Just money. Money. I mean, the thing that gets those guys fired is if the league stops making money. And the league is making money. And they're going to sign a new CBA this year. Or it'll probably make them even more money. So as long as the owners are happy and making a lot of money and feel like the game is in decent shape, other than personal scandal, it's pretty hard to get fired as a commissioner. Gary Bettman has never been fired. He's despised by every NHL fan who's watched the game for the last 30 years. They all hate him. He's fine. He'll be there every year.
Thanks, Mike.
See you guys.
I just saw some tweets going around here.
Uh-huh.
One of which, there's this guy, his name is Don LaGreca. He's a host at ESPN New York. He was suggesting that Major League Baseball would have been better off just covering this whole thing up and sweeping it under the rug. And is there anything to that?
I think it's...
I really do.
I mean, obviously, if you can get away with it without letting any of this stuff come out, I suppose they are better off.
It's not the right thing to do.
No,
they escape
not.
A PR nightmare because in order to get, it's like we talked about yesterday, what was the cost of getting the truth? The cost of the truth was any chance to punish them for their violations of rules. So you got the truth, but then what do you do with it?
What do you
do
with it?
And you said the important thing is that you have the truth for the sake of having it, that it's good for the game in the long term to have that. And it does change the way that people will forever look at that World Series title. But they would have avoided a PR nightmare that they've been having.
Yeah, I mean,
but they would have avoided that with the Astros behaving differently.
It's short-sighted because when I'm guessing when this host says Major League Baseball would have been better off, he's saying specifically Rob Manfred, the current group of owners. He's not saying baseball as a sport, as an entity from here until the end of time. I think he's saying just the people who are involved who have something to lose right now. Yeah, clearly they would have been better off by trying to cover it up or succeeding in covering it up because then none of this would have ever gotten out.
Do you think it does anything to the actual game of baseball itself? Like your question about is it bad that the biggest story we're talking about in sports right now is it's a baseball story, but it's a negative baseball story? Because I don't know that it hurts baseball as a sport. But that's just my perception.
It may actually help baseball in a weird way, but to me that's just kind of sad that it took a negative story, one in which a great team, a presumably great team, almost or may get their title stripped, something that's never happened in the history of baseball before.
Right.
Like, is it drawing attention and putting it on the game? Yeah, but what is that? That goes back to that thing I was talking about the other day. That's just hot-shotting the sport. You're pumping a little juice into it in the short term, but in the long term, it just kind of looks bad.
Right, and you still have all those problems, right? You still have all these issues that you still have to fix. If you're getting people to draw in to play or to watch baseball, then you gotta have a product that people are willing to stay for. And I don't know if that's necessarily the case for them right now.
Is there any way the number one pick in the draft can avoid going to Cincinnati? We'll talk about that next on 710 ESPN Seattle.
You're listening to Tom, Jake, and Stacy.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studio.
Streaming through the 710 Sports app and on 710sports.com.
Now here are your hosts, Tom Wassel, Jake Heaps, and Stacy Rost.
Just imagine for a second that the team that had the number one pick in the draft this year was the New York Jets or the Las Vegas Raiders or the Denver Broncos or some team that had a little bit of cachet. I know the Jets are a joke, but they do play in New York, which is a big deal. I know the Raiders have kind of been a joke, but they do have that name brand, and they are going to Las Vegas. That means something. If those teams had the number one pick in the draft, do you think that by now we would have heard Joe Burrow say something along the lines of, I can't wait to be the number one pick, and I can't wait to play in New York or Las Vegas or wherever?
Maybe not that direct, like, I can't wait to play there, but certainly he would say it would be very exciting to play there.
Okay.
He would signify that his excitement to be in that city and the potential of being the number one overall pick, like, it would not be a secret at that point where you're, you know, trying to figure out where Joe Burrow's thinking.
Right. So the reason why we bring this up is because Cincinnati has the number one pick, and I think it's a little strange that he hasn't gestured towards them at all.
And you're not the only one.
No.
That seems to be the narrative that's floating around with Joe Burrow right now, is that he is very specifically dodging saying anything about playing for Cincinnati because...
Or even being the number one pick.
Because he doesn't want to play for Cincinnati. And whether or not that's true, no one really knows, except for maybe those close to Joe and the people around him and in his camp. But, I mean, it's certainly a theory that's being floated by major sports networks and by folks on those networks. Carson Palmer before the Super Bowl was kind of hinting toward that as well.
Well, here's the question I want to explore, though, because right, what's today, February 19th?
Yes.
The draft is what, early May, late April, early May?
April 24th.
So we've got essentially 2 months. At any point in between now and then, will we know? The longer we go without knowing what Joe Burrow's intentions are, the more that tells me he don't want any part of Cincinnati.
Right.
Which I kind of get.
Yeah, and I would say right now that he probably doesn't want any part of Cincinnati.
Who would?
I would be very shocked to see this narrative change for Joe Burrow, unless Cincinnati just all of a sudden killed it in free agent market, but I don't think that they have that much cap space. So the part with Joe Burrow that he's got to figure out is, how does he navigate the situation? What does he do? Because when he makes a statement and says, well, I actually have leverage, you know, in this situation, it's, okay, what leverage do you really have other than saying that I'm just simply not going to play there? And is that going to work, right? Like, are you going to be able to make that happen? Do you have the same type of power and ability that the Manning family has, like Archie Manning and those guys? They have legit power and are amongst the power brokers in the NFL circles. Joe Burrow and his family, they don't have that same level of connection or power, but they do have, you know, a strong group around them. And going back to Stacey talking about Carson Palmer saying something, to me, I don't think that was a coincidence whatsoever. One of my good friends is Jordan Palmer, who Joe Burrow is training with down there in California, and that's the brother of Carson Palmer. And if I know anything about Jordan, I'm not saying he orchestrated this, but, you know, there are ways to get the message out there without Joe Burrow having to say anything. And
which message is that?
That
he doesn't want to go there?
That he doesn't want to go there. That he shouldn't go there, right? Like, there's positive messaging, not just, like, when we talk about Joe Burrow, we're talking about it going, hey, I get it. Like, I wouldn't want to play in Cincinnati either, instead of saying, how ungrateful is Joe Burrow?
Right.
You have an opportunity to be the first overall pick, and you're saying no? Are you kidding me? Like, so there is this narrative, this narrative out there that is sympathetic to Joe Burrow, and I don't think that's an accident.
If I'm the Bengals, would it be the worst idea in the world to get with Burrow and be like, look, we're going to pick you and trade you, or we're just going to trade the pick? Because they still have Andy Dalton, right?
Yeah, they still have Andy Dalton.
Okay, if they traded that pick and they got a haul for it, couldn't they build a pretty decent team? I mean, I think you could win. You might be able to win a Super Bowl or at least compete for a while with Andy Dalton if you were smart about using those picks that you got back.
Right. I mean, you definitely can.
Rather than being in a situation where the guy who doesn't want to be there in Joe Burrow and nothing else around him.
And here's the thing. As bad of a situation as it's been for Baker Mayfield, and it's really been more on Baker Mayfield than anything else, but you need a guy. If you're the Cincinnati Bengals, you need a guy that truly wants to be there, that's going to be a guy that loves being there every second, wants to be a game changer in the locker room, and you don't want to have questions about whether this guy even wanted to be a Cincinnati Bengal to begin with. And so that's not where you want to start and build around, especially if you're Zach Taylor, the head coach. You know, you want a guy that's all in and wanting to be there, and that's an important piece for them.
The narrative right now is that Joe Burrow does not want to be a Bengal. If he does want to be a Bengal, would it help him to come out and say that now? Or is he best just keeping quiet?
I think the best thing you can say is, it would be an honor to be taken first overall.
Yeah.
Like, you don't want to come out and say, I can't wait to be a Bengal, because if you don't get picked first overall, that's on loop on Twitter. Or people are panning you for that think that's a dumb decision.
Or even if you do get picked.
I think the approach that's most often taken is, it would be an honor to be first overall, and I know that any organization I go to, because the thing is, if you're a high draft pick, if you're a top five pick, certainly if you're top 10, but if you're a top five or number one overall, you're going to the worst team in football the year prior. So you already know you're going into a bad situation, which is one of the kind of drawbacks of being picked that high, is you know that you have a big workload ahead of you and a big challenge ahead of you. So I think that the best thing you could do, if you were fine with being selected by Cincinnati, would be to say that instead. I can't wait to be a first overall pick. It would be such an honor. I'm so excited. And we don't know that that's not how he feels.
Right.
But
still early.
Yeah.
But he's not giving us a whole lot to go
on.
That's for sure. He is definitely making more of a messaging. The messaging is more so the other way, that he does not want to be there. And so all signs point to that, and it'll be really interesting to see where it falls. And when you talk about, you know, being a first overall pick or a top five pick as a quarterback, yes, you're going to a bad team, but it's not always a dysfunctional organization. And with Cincinnati, it is known for being an organization that isn't willing or isn't a good organization to get them over the hump.
Does this Greg Olsen move by the Seahawks mean they're going for it in 2020? Or are they still building year by year? We'll talk about that next. Tom, Jake, and Stacy, 710 ESPN Seattle.